Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Are you a dummy? I mean, in the Spirit of the Dummies series of books. Andrew Daggus is the co-author of Stock Investing for Canadians for Dummies, and he'll be here to tell us about the basic tools you need to start investing. So now you've read the Dummies book and you're ready to start. Invisor might be a place you look to help you do that. Vice President Josh Misk is here to talk about Invisor GPS 2.0. It's their goal tracking system. And where do millennials stand on the financial literacy spectrum? The Public Policy Forum released a report called Millennial Money: Financial Independence and Well-Being for the Next Generation. Professor Jennifer Robson will be here to talk about the research and what policymakers can do with it. Millennials seem to be increasingly interested in investing in lots of things, like crypto assets. But that particular path doesn't come without risk. The Ontario Securities Commission's Tyler Fleming is here to talk about the two new educational initiatives that they're providing investors to help them get the knowledge before they start investing in crypto. And we'll talk to Michelle Silver about her book, Retirement and Its Discontents, Why We Won't Stop Working Even If We Can. All that is ahead. Let's get started. If you had the option to stop working right now, would you do it? Some people are like, where do I sign? I am ready. But others, they kind of think work's a part of their identity, and transitioning into retirement, they know, is going to be challenging. Michelle Silver has written a book on the latter group. It's called Retirement and Its Discontents, Why We Won't Stop Working Even If We Can. She's a professor at the University of Toronto. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce.
You are not a financial advisor. You come at this as a sociology professor. Why did you decide to write this book?
I think the financial aspects of retirement are really important, as I know you do as well.
Yep.
And I think that there's a lot of great books that have been written about that. And my book really focuses on the emotional aspects at the individual level, what it means to let go of work that has become an important part of a person's identity.
And certainly this is in the zeitgeist now, because when they talked about mandatory retirement age, you know, when whoever invented that, it was like you retire at 65 and you die at 67. It's 2 years. Enjoy. That is not the case when you look at the mortality tables. And many people, when they talk about it, they're not interested in that binary sort of work, 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 retire, retire, retire. So tell us a little about the themes that emerged in your research of why people aren't going to stop working even if they can.
Yeah, well, you know, you hit on a really great point, which is that, in fact, when original pension systems were developed in the latter part of the last century, actually the average person was supposed to be dead by the time they retired. So that window that you see, that, you know, we've come to see, actually wasn't even supposed to exist. And so one of the things that I map out in my book is the gap that has emerged between the average retirement age and life expectancy. And because we're living in what many agree are unprecedented times, we are living longer now than we ever have in all of human history. But we still have these sort of dated ideas about retirement and when people are productive and when they're expected to sort of disengage. And I think there's a lot to be said, as already mentioned, about implications of retirement. But I also think that at the societal level, we really lose out on many people who are at their best, who are, you know, experienced and skilled and honed at what they do by pushing them into a traditional sort of full stop retirement.
You interviewed lots of different people from various professions and did some categorization of those interviews by profession. How did you choose who you were going to talk to?
So, it's a long story, because I essentially did five different studies with people whose work was very important to their personal identity. Much of my work has focused on physicians. And so I have a chapter that, you know, focuses on physician retirement. From there, I ended up giving a talk to a group of people in the audience with someone who came up to me and said, you know, I think a lot of what you're talking about might resonate for CEOs. And I almost laughed, and I was like, you know, listening to what I said, you know, the CEOs have these, I imagine, like these luxurious retirements. And then never mind, how in the world am I going to get in touch with this type of sample? And he said, well, actually, I'm a CEO, and I think we can make this work. So from there, you know, some of the studies came from, you know, just connections. I interviewed people who had represented their country in Olympic Games, and that was sort of fortuitous because one of the campuses I work on in Scarborough built the Pan Am Athletic Center.
Right,
and there,
right.
Athletes from all over the world and coaches. It's a fantastic training ground. And
so let me choose one of the groups here. Yeah. Doctors, as you mentioned, my dad's actually a retired physician himself. What did you learn about that demographic group as it relates to retirement?
Yeah. So I learned that physicians give 150% of themselves to their job. They are on call and expected to wake up sometimes in the middle of the night and immediately jump into that role of, you know, making life or death decisions. And they're held accountable to those decisions. And they're acculturated through medicine, through the institution of medicine, to really prioritize their work over all other aspects of themselves. And so I learned that when they retire, because, you know, in many contexts, being a physician is like being a small business owner or an independent professional, that it's very difficult to keep it up partially and to gradually retire. And so they're essentially expected to go from giving 150% to zero. Mm. And that can be really challenging when all of your adulthood has been spent being really good at something, and with that, you know, comes a loss when you're expected to just give that up.
Homemakers was another group that you looked at, and this is interesting because certainly no one who has been a homemaker or seen them in action would ever call that anything but a pretty all-consuming job, certainly for a long chunk of the phase. How do they think about that shift into retirement, given that it wasn't from a traditional job?
Yes, exactly. And I want to point out, I studied them because I had spent years doing my PhD training looking at econometric modeling, and no economist would ever allow a homemaker to fit into that category, right, of being a retiree. And so when I got a chance to use some grant funding to do a study, I was really curious to see, you know, who identifies as retired and what is the criteria that people use. And so when I came into this group of homemakers, it was so fascinating to me to learn how they identified with this title, especially, you know, there's the saying, a homemaker's work is never done. But at the same time, there's this idea that, you know, they're not retirees because, you know, they're not paid for their work. It just doesn't come full circle. But yet I came into contact with this group, and, you know, what was really striking was how closely they identified with their life's work. It was really, it had brought them a great deal of fulfillment in ways that the CEOs and the athletes and all these other groups also identified with. Some of them, interestingly, liked the title of being retired. It's, you know, retirement is such an interesting topic and title because a lot of people hate it. People, you know, have all these mixed feelings. Some people can't wait to do it. For some of the homemakers, what was really interesting was how some of them enjoyed the title because it was ambiguous. It was preferable to other titles that, you know, sort of labeled them into.
It also makes sense. It also makes sense when you say, make your own darn dinner, because I'm retired. I'm not doing that anymore. Let me ask you, what did you learn that people can do to have the change go as smoothly as possible? So you talked to elite athletes, professors, you mentioned CEOs and doctors. Were there some things that people who have walked this path could provide for those that would follow them?
Absolutely. The last group I interviewed was academics. And what I learned from them was that, you know, continuing on with the aspect of your work that you find most fulfilling is really important. And the academics were quite good at that, right? They had lots of different things they did, whether it was teaching or research or service work. And many of them just sort of continued on, just picked the piece that they most enjoyed. And so the advice I would give is to say, you know, channel some of that energy that you devoted to your work into thinking about what is most fulfilling to you, and really allow yourself time to think about that. For some people, that means digging deep into their early adulthood or even earlier in life, because they haven't had time at all throughout their whole adulthood to breathe and develop hobbies and, you know, that sort of thing just hasn't happened. Mm. And so I would say, you know, really channeling that energy and practicing at it. You know, allowing yourself time to think about what do you want to do and not falling into the societal pressures to stop because there's some chronological age that is embedded in your head with retiring.
It's all made up anyway. Michelle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michelle Silver is the author of Retirement and Its Discontents, Why We Won't Stop Working Even If We Can. She's a professor at the University of Toronto.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You know the Dummies books? They've been around for like 30 years almost. Crosswords for dummies, iPads for seniors for dummies, basic practical how-to advice. Great stuff. Andrew Daggus is the co-author of Stock Investing for Canadians for Dummies, and he joins us now to talk about his book and some of the tools that it outlines. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
These is a great series, these books. They're targeted towards people who just really want to get started, but can get overwhelmed in a lot. I mean, please, an iPad, that's overwhelming. The stock market is nothing compared to trying to figure out technology. What are some of the tools that you mention in your book that every beginner investor needs to know about?
Well, some of the tools, first of all, it starts off as a book that deals with fundamentals. So it starts from the very beginning. It talks about investing by age. It talks about investing by style. A lot of the tools include basically stock screening tools, understanding how to read financial statements, which is essentially the language of business, which is another fundamental. Ratio analysis, online tools. The book references many online tools to reach resources that talk about investing, blogs, podcasts, all of the great stuff that an investor at any sophistication level could certainly use.
This is edition number 5. What were the things that you were focused on in this update?
Yeah, this update was an introduction in some really new and emerging areas. So one of them was the emergence of robo-advisors. We've all seen commercials by Wealthsimple, Questrade, BMO Smartfolio. Talking about robo-advisors, it's a shot across the bow of the industry. And I really wanted to introduce new things that are just emerging. Another part of the book that's new deals with cannabis, the whole emerging area there. And for sure, there are ups and downs in the market. Like there have been downs. But the reality of this emerging industry is it's a certainty. Asian stock markets as well. Markets have been choppy lately, but these are big markets with a lot of room to grow. A lot of risks in there, but a lot of opportunities as well. And I just wanted to put cryptocurrency investing, which is a four-letter word for many people, it is a type of financial instrument. And just wanted to put it on the map in this edition by devoting a chapter to that.
Now, what are the things that investors should know about risk and volatility?
Oh, risk is an absolutely important fundamental. So I mentioned earlier, Bruce, that you know, understanding financial statements, the language of business is really important. Understanding accounting, at least at the accounting 101 level, but risk is absolutely critical. Knowledge of risk management and how to mitigate those risks is absolutely essential. So there are many risks that exist at the market level, at the individual, at the industry level, and at the individual company level. So at the company level, for example, a company that you are thinking of investing in or somebody is invested in, risks that can come to the fore include strategic risk, just following the wrong strategy. We've seen that with BlackBerry. Reputational risk, when things really go south, it takes decades to build a reputation and minutes to lose that reputational advantage. And operational risks, things like supply chains breaking down. A product can be a hot seller, but if you don't have the widgets that are required to build that product or the people to execute a service, then that is a risk as well. And it's not just one risk. There are many risks that can come and bite the investor. Now, investing is risk is a double edge, is a two-sided coin. There is also opportunity. So risk is anything that stands in the way of an opportunity or an objective.
How do you communicate in a visceral way what a market downturn feels like to someone who has never seen it before? I mean, I've been around, so I saw the dot-com boom and bust and the declines post 9/11 and, you know, the financial crisis of 2008. But for, you know, a 22-year-old, they would have been 13 years old the last time they saw a correction. How do you give that piece of history in a way that has people realize, you know what, things can decline by 40% over the course of a very short period of time?
Exactly. No, that's a great question. And for somebody that hasn't experienced that before, and we've seen an incredible bull market lately, so there are a lot of people that haven't seen this. But at the visceral level, it's a lot of it is psychological. It is fear. There is surprise, as you had mentioned. The drops can be quite dramatic in a very short period of time. And that is the volatility that often welcomes new investors. I mean, investing can be a blood sport. And part of the negative part that a lot of people haven't seen are those quick drops, panic selling, media talking about stocks going down. The trick is to, as Warren Buffett often says, is to sort of buy what a lot of people are fearful and selling and to do the opposite. Likewise. But those are some of the visceral things that cause people to sometimes sell too early in what is otherwise a good, fundamentally sound stock, a stock that's a cash generator, a stock that has a great product and service. When the markets go down, all the boats go down with the water going down as well. But the truly great companies, the robust companies, the companies that are not laden with debt and that can survive a downturn will stay afloat. So the trick is psychological and not selling prematurely, or also not failing to sell when you should sell.
How do you put yourself in the mindset of a reader for whom not only do they have a low knowledge level because they want to read this book, but they also probably have some discomfort? Because one of the big challenges I run into all the time is people who are smart, who may be college or university educated, who have success raising teenagers, which is a miracle in and of itself. They still get overwhelmed by the prospect of learning about stock market investing. How do you put yourself into that mindset so that you can reassure them that they really do have what it takes to understand this material?
I think by keeping it straightforward and as simple and fundamental as possible. Now, not to say that that this book is a beginner book. It actually introduces some highly complex concepts, but with some levity and by using a lot of examples, just by breaking it down into things that are relatable. So that's number one, is not to bore people to death with the language and the lingo that comes with stock investing sometimes. Yes. The next is very much, as I mentioned before, just getting grounded in the fundamentals, getting grounded in knowing what the risks are is huge, because when you know the risks, it's easier to get into the uncharted waters of stock investing or any type of investing for that matter. I think it's also another way to ground somebody is by encouraging them to invest in stocks in an area that they know. These are some of the building blocks to break those psychological barriers to for people to wet their feet into stocks that haven't, especially those that haven't done that
right,
before.
Right. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us to talk about the book. We appreciate it.
Bruce, thank you very much for having me.
Andrew Dagas is the co-author of Stock Investing for Canadians for Dummies. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, financial literacy and millennials. Jennifer Robson is here to tell us about her findings in a new Public Policy Forum report. And later, we're going to talk about Advisor GPS 2.0 with the company's Vice President Josh Misk. If you're looking for some books to help you with your personal finances, in addition to the Dummies book, you could pick up a copy of Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things with Their Money and What You Can Do About It. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
How do millennials compare to the generations that came before them when it comes to financial literacy? Jennifer Robson is an associate professor at Carleton University and a fellow of the Public Policy Forum. She joins us from Ottawa now and is here to discuss the latest report from PPF called Millennial Money, Financial Independence and Well-Being for the Next Generation. Hello there.
Hi.
What are the challenges that millennials actually face? And I say actually because there's so many that people talk about. What are the ones that you found to be most relevant in your research?
Yes, that is an excellent point. There is no shortage, right, of kind of stereotypes and stories out there about millennials. And I think, part of what my report is doing is maybe challenging some of those. I think we've taken a lot of the stories from the U.S. and the U.K. where it's really clear millennials there are facing like really big challenges. In Canada, the story is a little different. They're not wasting their money on avocado toast.
Mm-hmm.
They do have some challenges, though, and so let me go to those specifically. So compared to Gen Xers at the same age, for example, and that's really, really important, right? Because when we just compare millennials to Gen X and boomers today, things don't look so great. So we've got to compare apples and apples. Anyway, millennials today are more likely to be carrying some student debt. They're more likely to be carrying more of that. They do seem to have a tougher time with regards to making ends meet, like keeping up with regular payments. They are more likely to report financial stress. And interestingly, compared to Gen X, again, at the same age, they're actually more likely, rather, to have somebody in the household who is part of a workplace pension, but they're also more likely to have nobody with any retirement savings at all. So you've kind of got this like bifurcation within the millennial group. So some interesting stuff going on.
And surprisingly, their level of financial literacy is pretty strong. That surprised me.
So I think this is one of those tropes, right? That, kids today, they don't know anything about money. We got to learn them up. We got to teach them how to budget. And I think what my results show is that, 18 and 19-year-olds, they don't know an awful lot yet, right? Remember, today, as I'm talking to you, that's the age of the youngest millennial.
Right.
But it turns out that as they age, they kind of catch up to the rest of Canadians. Now, look, the financial literacy levels of Canadians writ large is not amazing, right? Like
yep.
We could probably all do with a little learning on that front.
You'll need to listen to my show a little bit more. I'll learn you.
There you go. So, but millennials are not different in this respect.
Right. So what the distinction we're making here is that there are things that are generational and then there are things that are life stage.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, your report found that they're performing unexpectedly well, your phrase, in some areas. What are some of those areas?
So I would say one of the areas that really stands out to me, as I said before, was the participation in workplace pensions. I had to rerun that number myself a couple of times.
Is this self-reported? Is this what they're saying?
So these are households that are headed by a millennial, and it's does anybody in the household participate in a pension? And StatsCan, this is all Statistics Canada data, they don't just ask the survey respondent. They're also able to go and link it with, for example, tax data, right, to be able to have that backstop to check. So this is not just self-reported, because you're right. Some people may think that they have a pension and or may not realize they have one.
It also seems to contradict the overarching stat that certainly defined benefit pension plans have been on the decline for years.
So I think, you know, that one kind of in terms of the broad coverage rates of defined benefit, yes, those are coming down. We don't, you know, my report doesn't delve into whether the pensions are defined benefit or defined contribution. But certainly having some workplace pension is better than no workplace pension. Mm. Outside of retirement savings, another thing that really jumped out at me was that when you compare current millennials who are 25 to 33 to Gen X, when they were 25 to 33, home ownership rates haven't come down. They haven't changed.
Interesting.
Price of housing has gone way up, right?
Yeah.
And we know in some markets it's really tough to get in, like, you know, in around Toronto, Vancouver, Calgary to some degree. But overall, across the country, home ownership rates for this generation haven't come down.
You have a number of policy ideas, which I think is interesting, because we talk in, you know, flowery language about these issues and the solutions. But you've got some very interesting policy ideas, beginning with one around student loan repayment. We know that's a big issue. University, mm-hmm. post-secondary education is very expensive, and that certainly has outpaced inflation. How does one make student loan repayment easier?
So the government, the federal government, that is, already has some measures in place. And I think it was two budgets ago, they tweaked the system, right, to make it a little more generous so that you didn't start, if you were a student loan borrower federally, you didn't start any repayment until you were making at least $25,000 a year. That's definitely a positive step. But half of the people who are eligible for that repayment assistance don't even apply. Hmm. Looks like some of that is due to, look, any time that you create something that's going to be opt-in, right, you're going to leave out some people. We also make it complicated in that once you apply, you have to keep reapplying every 6 months. So, right. You know, we could do more to make that system simpler, and we could proactively contact borrowers who look like they're probably eligible.
Right. You also reference the challenge that small savers have, that the big, you know, registered program like the TFSA and the RRSP are for people who have, you know, a lot more assets. What could the government do, or what could policymakers mm-hmm. do, not just at the level of government, do to help small savers?
Great question. So, you know, when I talked before about millennials having more trouble making ends meet, they are also less likely to have some liquid savings that they could fall back onto. And, you know, that was really kind of the original purpose behind tax-free savings account, in addition to kind of longer-term savings for low-income savers who were being penalized by treatment of RRSPs. But this actually is an idea that I think is interesting and worth talking about. There's a group in Toronto, Commonwealth, that has been, you know, starting to mm-hmm. do some work around this. And it's basically to say, look, you know, you don't get a tax break in terms of a deduction or anything positive like that for putting money into into a TFSA. But maybe what we could do is support small savers, right? So people who don't have huge tax liability, so mm-hmm. they're not going to get anything out of putting money into an RRSP, with something like a saver's credit, right? So if you put money in, government will match that. We already do something similar, or try to anyway, with registered education savings plans.
Right.
Maybe this is something worth exploring for tax-free savings accounts too.
Another one, you talk about sustainable short-term credit, looking at the needs of younger consumers and that as a particular. Is this, can I connect this to the challenge that many people find themselves in when their last resort becomes a ridiculously high interest rate or a payday loan company?
I think there's part of that. I think my data also suggests that millennials are more likely to be carrying credit card debt too, yeah. right? And that makes sense if they're having trouble keeping up with their regular obligations and making ends meet and falling behind on things, right? That how do they fit the shortfall? Well, they turn to credit. So I don't see any signs in my data that vast numbers of millennials are turning to fringe financial lenders, but I think that's still something to keep an eye on. But just more generally, right, making sure that people have access to affordable credit to smooth some of those bumps. And it's not necessarily to, you know, large amounts of personal, you know, personal loans, those kinds of things. But yeah, it's really about making sure that when people have shortfalls, that they have options to look at that are going to be, as you know, as you said, sustainable from the financial service provider's perspective, but also from the household's perspective.
One of your other recommendations is to help millennials plan ahead, which we know, I mean, we do tons of stories on behavioral economics here. It's very difficult for any consumer, regardless of their age, to think that far in the future. You think the CRA could play a role here. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah. So this one is actually, while I think that this could have an impact on those millennial households where nobody has any retirement savings, I think this is actually something that, you know, more Canadians in general, like I know I could probably benefit from this. CRA already gets an awful lot of information from all of us when we file our return about, did we put anything into an RRSP? Are we in a pension plan? What CPP contributions did we put in? But all of these bits and pieces of information, if you wanted to find them for yourself, you got to hunt and you know, look at a couple of different information sources. So, you know, it's a bit like that idea of biofeedback, right? When you're trying to learn how to do something new, you get that kind of regular feedback. And so why not have CRA send us all as part of a simplified notice of assessment, personalized information that gives us that regular annual feedback on what we're doing vis-a-vis our retirement. Mm. It's good timing given that, you know, the new CPP enhancements are about to start coming on board as well.
And many of us pay attention to anything that comes from the CRA. It makes my blood run cold when I get a letter from them. So that's good.
There is that, you know, I think CRA is more broadly, though, trying to make changes in how it communicates with Canadians and to become more client focused, to become, you know, more user friendly, to be able to put out notices of assessment that actually makes sense to people. And this just seems like information that people would actually find useful.
Great idea. And there's so much of the infrastructure is already there, not just from a data standpoint, but they also know how to mail a letter. So that's something.
True, they do. It's kind of
Jennifer,
low-hanging fruit.
This is really, really important work, and I appreciate you taking the time to come talk to us about it.
Oh, thank you for being interested. Thanks a lot.
Jennifer Robson is an associate professor at Carleton University, a fellow of the Public Policy Forum, and her report was Millennial Money, Financial Independence and Well-Being for the Next Generation. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll take you through the Moo-la-la questionnaire with Professor Michelle Silver of U of T. But next, the Ontario Securities Commission's Tyler Fleming is here to tell us about their latest crypto asset initiative. If you've got a question about money, and maybe I've already answered it somewhere, I'm the Money Columns for Money Sense, and you can find our segments on moneysense.ca. Then just search for my name or read the other people. They're equally, if not more, amazing in their insight and wisdom. Stay with us. There's more Moo-la-la after the break.
You're listening to Moo-la-la, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The recent volatility of crypto assets like Bitcoin has generated a lot of interest from investors and from regulators. Most of us know very little about what's behind these investments and the risks involved. The Investor Office at the Ontario Securities Commission has launched a new crypto asset educational initiative. Tyler Fleming's the director of the Investor Office, and he joins us now to tell us more. Hi there.
Hi, Bruce.
Tell us what you're doing on the crypto front. I mean, I think the day that I realized how important this was for us to talk more about was the day my 15-year-old nephew told me he was buying Bitcoin. And I was terrified. Not that he's not one of the smartest 15-year-olds you have ever met in your life, but still, it was a level of engagement that surprised me.
Yeah, it's certainly an area that has exploded in interest, certainly since late 2017. All of a sudden, people all around the world were talking about and purchasing these new complex financial products, and many of them didn't necessarily fully understand them. Mm. So we've done a few things here at the OSC, which I can speak about. One, we just launched a couple new educational initiatives. So there are two websites that are intended to help educate investors about the sector. And we also conducted and published some research on the sector as well, which led to some interesting findings, including the fact that young men in particular are more interested in this sector.
Get smarter about crypto.ca is the first one. It's a great site. It's interactive and built in a way that it's very of the moment. What are some of the things that people will learn when they go to that site?
Sure. So this is, as you mentioned, it was a website we launched, Get Smarter About Crypto, that has a lot of kind of cool features and graphics, really intended to engage a target audience, which is namely younger investors in this case. And on that website, we'll walk through what crypto assets are, how they work, where you can buy them, and different types of products related to the sector. GetSmarterAboutCrypto.ca. It's meant to help investors learn more about products and services in the crypto asset space, the OSC's role in regulating them, and also provide tips for exercising due diligence before buying this type of investment.
And what does due diligence mean here? I mean, due diligence in a when you're buying a traditional stock, you know, maybe you read the financial, you read the financials, the annual report. What does due diligence look like when you're talking about crypto? Because most of these are names I don't recognize and from firms that I have never even heard of.
That's right. So I mean, a lot of this is asking investors and consumers to do their homework. I'll go through a few tips in just a sec, but I should mention another website we launched, the tbacoin.ca, and this one mimics what fraudulent websites that we've seen do. So you'll see things like promises of high returns with little to no risk or guaranteed performance, outsized claims about the product, a lot of unverifiable information, not necessarily connected to any real management teams. So if you go to tbacoin.ca, you'll see all sorts of features that are actually what fraudsters in the sector are using. Now, that's not to say there are not a lot of legitimate products in the sector, and we want to be clear about that. So when it comes to due diligence, I'd say, you know, people need to make sure they understand what the product is meant to do. You know, is it right for you? People should look into if it's tied to a business and do some research on the management team and the business model. Often, you know, management teams will make themselves available to answer questions from prospective investors. But if you can't reach a management team, that might be a red flag fraud. You know, we encourage people to look for independent and unbiased information and advice, and we have several resources to help them with that, including our flagship website, GetSmartAboutMoney.ca.
Who would crypto be right for? And I know even that question makes me sound like an 85-year-old curmudgeon living off the grid with a box of tuna under my bed, but I still don't get the applicability to regular Canadians on getting into crypto.
Yeah, so it's not for everyone. I think individual circumstances are unique, which is why we encourage people not only to educate themselves, but have a long-term plan when it comes to their money and follow that plan. You mentioned early on some of the volatility in crypto prices. Just recently, there's been a further drop, compounding further drops in earlier in the year. The total market cap of the crypto asset market has fallen by about 83% since its all-time high this past January. And so I guess we'd remind people that skyrocketing returns never last forever, and crypto assets have been no exception. But nonetheless, they haven't gone away, and the technology that powers them can foster innovative ways to raise capital and has the potential to increase transparency and efficiency.
You highlighted some of the research you've done. One of the data points that really struck me was the number of people. I mean, it was an Ontario sample. 5% of people in Ontario hold some sort of crypto asset. First of all, did I get the stat right? And second of all, does that surprise you as much as it surprised me?
It's consistent with, you got the stat right. It's consistent with other research that has been done, including from the Bank of Canada. So it's consistent with what we might have expected, but it was good for us to get our own data. So you're right. We found about 5% of Ontario adults own crypto assets at the time the research was conducted, and this translates to about 500,000 Ontarians. We also found an additional 4% of Ontarians at the time had previously owned crypto assets in the past, but no longer did. We also found some interesting data on how much people were spending and whether they were going into debt to spend it. We wanted to investigate that. So over 90% reported spending under $10,000, but 9% of people, about 50,000 Ontarians, spent $10,000 or more acquiring these crypto assets. Most people were paying in cash for it, 55%, but another 26% bought them on a credit card, and another 3% borrowed money elsewhere.
If you were to sum it all up, all the work that you've done on research, all the work that you've done on the educational initiatives, what is the one message that you would want people to take away if they're seriously considering some exposure in the crypto asset category?
Well, I'd go even beyond that. I'd say, you know, new opportunities or emerging sectors often provide excitement and new opportunities for investing. But it is important, regardless of the sector, whether it's crypto assets or more recently we've seen the cannabis industry, that people do their homework, number one, make a long-term plan and understand their goals and their needs. Mm. and make sure they understand the products that they're investing
in. You must hear some crazy stories, Tyler.
Our contact center gets lots of calls and questions, and we've heard a lot. Yeah.
Tyler Fleming, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bruce.
Tyler is the director of the investor office at the Ontario Securities Commission. He was joining us to talk about the new crypto asset educational initiatives that they have recently launched. Stay with us. Coming up next, we'll talk to Invisor's John Misk about Invisor GPS 2.0. And we'll take Michelle Silver through the Moolala questionnaire. Here I am on social media, at Bruce Celery on Twitter, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. I am not Facebook. Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. I don't do Snap. I don't do Insta. I'm an old soul. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Celery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There is a lot of talk these days about robo-advisors. There's standalone robo-advisors. There's discount brokers that offer some of these services. The big banks are even getting in the game, too. One that has been around for a while is a company called Invisor, and they are launching this new sort of gold tracking functionality on their site called Invisor GPS 2.0. We thought that was a good opportunity for us to bring them in to talk a bit more about their service and how they are going to focus on helping Canadians get a better handle on their money. Invisor's Vice President Josh Misk is joining us now. Hi there.
Hey, Bruce. How are you? Thanks for having me.
GPS 2.0, what is it and how does it work?
So GPS is a goal planning solution is what we call it. And what it is it's a high-level view of a client's investment savings and their insurance needs. And what it does is it helps them map out exactly what they need to save, visualize the progress towards getting to that goal, and then the subsequent divestment of their assets after they reach that goal.
What are some questions that the service would ask me in order to frame out what my goals actually are?
Well, there's a lot that goes into it. So what we do is we take a look at your overall ability to take risk and your willingness to take risk, and we factor that into the growth rates that we use. We look at how long you have till you reach your goals, and once you get there, how long you're going to be, you know, spending that money over.
How many goals can I have?
Up to four right now.
Up to four.
Yes.
And do they have to fit in a particular category, or does my birthday trip to Tuscany fit?
That would fit.
Yeah. Are you going to pay for my trip to Tuscany?
If you do well enough, if you bring enough people on board to Invisor, maybe.
It's not happening. I get no toasters or nothing for anything. Why only four? People have a lot more than four goals.
We wanted to keep it simple. You know, there's a lot you can do. One of the ones that we don't have right now is an income goal. We're working on building it out. But when it comes to building something that's user-friendly in particular, you have to keep it as simple as possible. We've tried to keep it as simple as possible. I think often there are so many tools that are built out there that are overly complex, and it's great. They can do everything. They got all the bells and whistles. But as a person trying to use them, it's hard to make sense of it, and it's easy to get overwhelmed. So we've kept it narrowly focused, and it works for most people.
How does the GPS differ from what's out there on offer from other institutions, and how is it similar to what's on offer?
I think more and more firms, you mentioned we started a while back, we always had this goal drive when we're looking towards really mapping out people's investment planning. When it comes to other firms now, there other firms are looking at bringing in more and more of the goal-based solution. When you think about investing, it's the right way to do it. You know, what are you saving for? And it's saving for retirement or saving for my kids' education. And that's what more and more are starting to do. I think where we differ is we do factor in, more of the holistic picture. We bring in insurance as well as the investing goal. So, when you're looking at your whole financial picture, this offers you a bit more of a holistic view.
How do you frame the insurance in the context? How do you frame insurance in the context of goals? Because it's hugely important, especially if someone has young kids. But it's not like someone's like, ooh, I have a goal to have so much insurance. That they don't think that way. They think about protection against calamity. So is it more adherence to some basic principles around insurance? Like, is it binary? Do you have insurance, or how does it work?
Yeah, we factor in what people have told us about themselves. So it's your age, and it's your income level, your savings. If you are saving, if you do have kids, for example, and you're saving towards their education, and you're 20% of the way there, well, we'll factor in that other 80% into an insurance need when you're looking at your life insurance goals. So we take in as much as we know about you, again, with keeping it simple to try and map out exactly what that need is. I think it's very, very important to have a high level idea of what an insurance need is for people. And again, you can get overwhelmed. You can go to all these other tools, and you can get really into the weeds with exactly how much you need, but that's going to change. It's going to change every day.
Coming back to the goals thing, I'm a big believer in this, and have been for a very long time. One of the things that is often a hurdle is people's inability to manage cash flow to improve their ability to meet their goals, right? Like, they need to either increase income or cut spending in order to have more cash flow to forward those goals. How does the GPS include that part of the equation?
Well, we factor in your expected contributions on an annual basis. So when we're looking to map out your long-term goal and how you're going to get there, we say, how much can you put into this goal every year? And when you break it down on an annual basis, you can see that, okay, if I changed what I'm going to contribute to my goal from, $1,000 a year to $3,000 a year, how much more likely is it that I get there? It's interesting when you look at somebody that's a younger person, and this is one of the reasons why we built this as well, is it from a holistic view. When you're looking at your investments, you want to see things from a long-term perspective and how it really maps out to your ability to achieve your goal. So when you get worried about little market blips here and there, if we help you to frame it in that long-term perspective, then it's a much easier thing to really see exactly what you're going to do to get there. And by separating it out to say, these are the contributions that I have to make every year, it becomes more apparent that the contributions that you make have a much larger impact on your ability to reach that goal than the actual market itself.
Does GPS 2.0 include notifications back to clients on particular milestones? I ask because, when you sign up for one of those free credit score programs, we know they're selling you products. That's why they're doing it. But there's a real there's a loop from the credit score back to you on an ongoing basis. Does that loop exist in what you have designed?
Yeah, a little bit. And we're continuing to improve it. But there's an immediate feedback loop, and there's an immediate, how far is your progress right now? Right now you're at 80% of the way to get to your goal. If you increase your savings a little bit more, then you can get to that 100% and you're on track. We also use it to help us check in with the client on an annual basis. So when somebody has a goal, say they're saving for their kids' education in 6 years, we know that next year, now it's 5. So that time that we circle back to that client, it really helps us to monitor their progress as we track it.
Just briefly before we go, does that declining time horizon automatically affect the asset allocation on education savings?
Yeah, it would. So the nice thing about this is it's not only a visual tool, but it dynamically tracks as you're moving towards something.
Same on retirement.
So we're looking at your age, your change in your investment balances, the change in your personal situation. So if your risk tolerance changes year over year, it's going to change with you. It's a dynamic tool that monitors. Because it's when you do a financial plan, for example, you do it once.
Right.
Or maybe once every 5 years. This is designed to be something that you could look at on a daily basis and something that would reassure you if the market, say, dips, like I said, 20% or it's going to go down. Well, it doesn't factor into your long-term goals as much as you may think that it does.
Right. Very interesting. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Misk is Vice President of Invisor, here to talk about Invisor GPS 2.0. Time now for the Moolala questionnaire. This is our series of questions about money and life. Our guest is Michelle Silver. She is a professor at the University of Toronto and the author of Retirement and Its Discontents. Michelle, just the first thing that comes to your mind. You ready?
Okay.
How would you describe your money personality?
Cautious.
Cautious. And have you always been cautious, or were you like footloose and fancy free and then something happened?
I think I'm generally cautious with occasional bursts of footloose.
And if there was a burst, where would that burst occur? In a store or with a travel agency, or what would you say one of your guiltiest spending pleasures is?
It's when I'm traveling and outside of my element.
Ooh, okay. Can you think of an example of where you have been recently and one thing that you bought that would fit with that definition of burst?
I was at a conference in Boston and I bought a small ice cream maker for $20.
Oh, that's, and have you used it?
No.
Hey!
But it was really recently.
Okay, all right. And now, you know, we'll see when the weather gets warmer, whether or not you haul that thing out. I love it. Who was your money mentor growing up, would you say?
An aunt.
And what did she teach you, either by osmosis or by language?
She was an avid investor and an independent businesswoman, and she taught me to invest early.
Oh, and when she talked about investing, did she mean in the stock market or invest in your skills or your education? Or
she was all about the stock market.
Yeah, she was like, yeah. Yep, this is just like working girl, invest in the stocks.
Mm-hmm.
What is one thing you worry about? With the working girl reference was the Melanie Griffiths movie. That's what I was talking about. What is one thing you were that you worry about when it comes to money?
I worry about not having it.
Not having it. Now, in the academic world, you are working towards a pension. Is that a bit of a salve?
Yes. Having a pension, I'm grateful for that. Yes.
What was one of your worst financial mistakes?
Oh, when I moved to Canada, I converted my currency to... so stupid. I converted when the exchange rate was on par, and I just didn't. I mean, the whole world felt like it was 2008. It felt like things were going crazy, and I thought, okay, I'm moving here. I'm committing to being here. But if I had just waited,
were you moving from the United States?
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. So that may have been your worst financial mistake, but would you say that was also your best move?
Best move to be Canadian and to work here. And, you know, I'm very grateful. But financially, just, you know, I didn't have a good sense of the bigger picture and international exchange rates. I didn't quite realize.
Yeah.
That it's usually not on par.
Right. Well, you've written a book on retirement from the perspective of a sociologist. When do you plan to retire, and what will you do?
I don't. I mean, you know, my big story, or you know, my big theme is that people are getting pushed into retirement. At, you know, based on their chronological age. And I really believe that people should listen to their instincts. And, you know, of course, some people can't wait to retire. But there is a big societal loss for those who are being pushed into it. So I personally am not, you know, not looking at retiring anytime soon.
If you landed a huge financial windfall, say $25 million, which is like 50 million US dollars, I don't know. what would you do with it?
You know, I'd give back. I'd travel. I'd invest in my family, my community, university.
You'd be very careful about currency moves as well, I'm sure. If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
Just having so many things. There's definitely a overconsumption in certain regions of the world. And I think, you know, environmentally, that it would be best if we could change that? And also, if we could think about it from a more global perspective in terms of redistributing. So, you know, some parts of the world have so many, 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 many things, and some parts just don't have anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah.
The thingness of the world we live in today. Michelle, thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you.
Michelle Silver is the author of Retirement and Its Discontents. She is a professor at the University of Toronto. That's our show for today. If you want some more Moolala, you can download the podcast version of the show. You can also subscribe to it so it just shows up in your player. We are on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and now on Spotify. If you've got a comment or question or a story idea, someone you think we should know about, like Michelle, send us a note to ask@moolala.ca. That's spelled M-O-O-L-A-L-A.ca. Thanks very much for joining us. Have a great day.